Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 87. So if you were in Minneapolis this last weekend and came to my show at the Varsity Theater, I thank you. Oh my god, that show was so much fun. I met a ton of cool nerds afterwards. Still gotta get people to start dressing up for these shows. I saw a couple Tom Baker scarves, but that was really about it. So start dressing up for my shows, which, by the way, are coming up on the Chaotic Good Comedy Tour. Brooklyn, May 20th. Second show added at the Littlefield, 10 p.m. Seattle, June 4th. Detroit, June 10th. Dallas, June 11th. Also, Nerd Melt shows at Meltdown in L.A., Nerdist Theater. Matt Myra's Day Off. Sunday's the open mic that Matt Myra hosts with Paul Sebas. Sign-ups at 7:30, shows at 8. May 12th, Rove McManus and Axis of Awesome for Aussie Night. Go to Nerdist.com for info and ticket links for all of those shows. And big announcement, July 23rd, Nerdist Podcast Live at San Diego Comic-Con. Hashtag SDCC. Yes, we're going to be doing a show in the evening, July 23rd at 4th and B. Tickets will be available soon. Guest TBD, but there will be an awesome guest, and Matt, Joan, and I will be there, so please get ready to come to that. Also, the 2011 limited edition Nerdist shirts are here. Pre-orders until May 23rd. They ship May 31st, also at Nerdist.com. Our returning sponsor this week is Carbonite.com. All right, so I'm sure you've heard the dreaded click from your spinning hard drive plate. Sooner or later, our computers will fail us. I've been there. I have screamed many a time at my computer, wanted to put my fist through it. But do not rely on your hardware alone. So with Carbonite, your files are automatically backed up whenever you're connected to the internet. Plus, you will get anytime, anywhere access to your files with a smartphone and iPad app. Unlimited backups, only $59 a year. That is the best insurance you will ever pay. Hardware is replaceable, nerds, but your work is not. So let Carbonite take care of that for you. Start your 15-day trial today at Carbonite.com. And if you use the offer code Nerdist, you will get 2 free months if you decide to buy. Carbonite. We thank them for their continued sponsorship. And now, the Nerdist Podcast number 87 with Mr. Ed Helms.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Did your mic just farted?
It's just
I don't hear it.
It's making fart sounds.
Ed, why is your mic making fart sounds?
I don't know.
That's so bizarre. Are you having mic queefs?
Mic queefs?
A little bit of mic queefs. Ed Helms, we're recording. This is it. This is how it starts. There's no setup really. There's no big our next guys who I know. We don't do any of that. We just start blabbing.
We stumble into a room.
Mm-hmm. Ladies and nerds and gentlemen and people and geeks, we are in a severe crisis here. We are desperately trying to find an app that will remotely control your iPad.
Well, let's be clear. I don't know if it's an app or a device. It may be a separate thing.
Something you connect to it?
Yeah, something to remotely control and not through like a wire connection. But maybe if you could ghost your iPad from your iPhone perhaps, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that things that you're doing on your iPhone, someone else holding your iPad is looking at.
Seems like you should be able to do that.
I would think so.
So let's have a little backstory. Ed Helms does an amazing show at Largo. It's really a weekend, the LA Bluegrass situation.
Well, yeah, there's sort of two separate things that get joined up on this weekend. There's the I do a show periodically at Largo called the Whiskey Sour Radio Hour, which you've been a part of before, Mr. Hardwick.
I did. I sang a rock bluegrass version of the Titanic theme.
My heart will go on. Exactly. Yes.
With you playing, I don't know if a lot of people know this about you. You're a phenomenal banjo player.
Well, that's a liberal interpretation of the word phenomenal, but I do play, and that was really fun.
It really was fun.
Yeah, I might have a recording of that. That we could play and get
really?
and get sued for.
Is it all covers?
What, the band?
Is there a lot of covers in the throughout the weekend?
So the show, the Whiskey Sour Radio Hour, is just this show that I do from time to time, and it's kind of this crazy variety show with a lot of really fun bluegrass music featuring my old band, The Lonesome Trio, a bunch of other musicians. And then we have comedy, ridiculous stuff going on, too. This weekend we had Tom Lennon on and Will Ferrell, and along with some great music. And last year you were on it, which was great. Tried to get you this year.
I was out of town. I know.
Didn't work.
I know. I was in Florida. I was in Florida.
Was it worth it, Chris?
No, it wasn't worth it. I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to be doing, because
I know how much you love Florida.
It's great. It feels really good to go outside and then instantly have to mop the dripping sweat off your eyeballs and to suck in the air and taste water. It feels really good. And also that sheen of sweat really creates a nice, like you're like an ant under a microscope lens.
Mm-hmm.
Void of any breeze.
None.
Is it inappropriate that I'm incredibly aroused right now?
By that Chris can explain anything and make it sexy.
Yeah.
Taxes.
I was having double bypass surgery. The surgeon slid two fingers into my aorta. And then he had the nurse smell them.
So the Whiskey Sour Radio Hour is also something that we incorporate into an annual event called the LA Bluegrass Situation, which is four nights of shows at Largo. And it's very bluegrass oriented. And this year we had an incredible lineup. It was just this last weekend. Thursday night was Sarah and Sean Watkins with the Watkins Family Hour.
Amazing.
And Chris Thiele popped in. They had a Nickel Creek reunion.
Oh, nice. That's awesome.
Absolutely bananas.
Cover of Spit on a Stranger by Pavement is one of the best cover songs I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah.
They're so awesome.
They're absolutely bananas. And then Friday night was Chris Thiele's band, the Punch Brothers, mm-hmm. who are banana cakes. And then Saturday night was my show, the Whiskey Sour Radio Hour, which we did two of back-to-back, which I don't know if I'll ever do again.
That was a lot.
It was brutal, but so fun. The second show, everyone was a little bit tipsy and got a little crazy. It was really fun. And then Sunday night was Steve Martin with a fabulous band called the Steep Canyon Rangers.
Yes.
And Steve, as you know, is an extraordinary banjo player.
Yeah.
Drop Thumb Medley. I mean, I used to listen to, like, I listened to his banjo playing on the old comedy records as much as I listened to the bits.
The Steve Martin brothers?
The Steve Martin brothers. I'm actually surprised I didn't pick up the banjo because of Steve Martin.
I actually tried to pick up the banjo because of Steve Martin. I was obsessed. I had a King Tut 45. And on the other side was just two different banjo tunes that he did. And I was like, oh, my God, to be in comedy, you also have to learn how to play the banjo. I thought in my head, that's what I thought you had to do. And so I was saving up money every week. I was like doing a bunch of chores. My dad was giving me a little bit of money at a time. And then I had a number that I had to get up to because it was at the Coconut Grove at the used music shop. There was a banjo for $350. So I was like saving up money. I finally get enough money. I go in, and as I'm walking up the stairs to Coconut Grove, there's a dude walking down the stairs with a banjo. I was like, oh, that kind of looks like the banjo I was going to get. Well, time to go get that banjo. And then I get up there, and the guy's like, oh, no, dude. Because I'd been going in and trying to play with it and kind of checking it out. And the guy at the used music shop.
How old were you?
I was probably 12.
So then you just wasted the money on Samoan blowjobs. Jonah grew up in Hawaii.
This is so sad.
It really is.
I mean, this is like a very poignant.
Fate said to you, you will not play this banjo.
No, no.
That was the only banjo in Hawaii.
That actually was. Yeah, they're not a big banjo.
I did look around. It was just the cheapest one I could afford. And like, you know, I got into playing the drums.
Which is sort of like an unstringed banjo.
Yeah,
it is.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, so we were talking about how cool it was. I used an iPad as my set list during the show, and what we were talking about is how cool it would be if someone, like a stage manager off stage, could scroll a document on the iPad on the stage.
And also fling you notes if you need them, like push notes and things.
Ooh, yeah.
Like,
oh, maybe, wow, yeah, yeah, like yeah. Send updates.
Little
or
bubbles.
Yeah, which, you know, he could do if he... That actually you could do because you share a Dropbox folder with him. And he can put stuff in his Dropbox folder, and then it'll appear in your Dropbox.
Well, but you'd have to. But the point is, the whole point, Hardwick, the reason I'm talking about this to
you're
begin
very
with
angry,
is that you, on stage you don't want to touch the thing.
That's true.
You want it just to mirror, or just to like someone remotely control it, so that you know, sort of like a teleprompter where somebody's actually controlling the speed of the scrolling text.
Yeah.
And there are teleprompter apps for iPad, but they do they act on preset timings. It's not,
so if you fuck up, it's like it's not going to stop for you.
Yeah, it won't stop for you. Exactly.
Have you ever thought about honing your capacitive telekinesis skills?
Well, that would just blow up.
What?
iPad would just blow up.
No, it wouldn't. You'd just be able to control it with your mind, is the point.
If your mind was that strong, wouldn't you be able to just remember the...
You know, that's a different part of the brain, Jonah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry, you're clearly not a neuroscientist.
I haven't seen Phenomenon in a long time, starring John Travolta.
Oh, God, why'd you bring it up? He lives in the flowers. He lives in the air. That was such a weird turn that movie took, where it's like, oh, my God, this guy has these cool powers. Oh, it's a tumor.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen Phenomenon by this point, it's probably not high on your list.
Yeah, you know, there's two types of people, the Phenomenon people and then people who like the movie Michael. And, you know, when it comes to their fantasy
categories.
Yeah.
I'm a Look Who's Talking guy.
Yeah.
Look Who's Talking to, Look Who's Talking now. Now was with the animals.
Yeah, the dogs.
But
Danny DeVito.
Did they both have John Travolta?
Yeah, they all have John Travolta. They all have John Travolta.
Yeah.
All
right.
Or is Blanca Patrick Collar Kirstie Boulevard?
Yeah, I know. That's think about just joke. I love actually the first Look Who's Talking was I know.
I'm not laughing at that.
No, not
I'm glaring
at
you both.
Yes, in disapproval. There should be some sort of a remote because you can remotely control your computer, your desktop computer through your apps. You can remotely control your Apple TV through your iPad and through your iPhone.
Right.
So it seems like you should be able to remotely control your iPhone from your iPad and vice versa.
Well, now here's what you can do, which is really cool, is you can plug in. I think you can use your iPad to control like a big multimedia presentation.
Yes, through Keynote.
Keynote. Right. You can use the Keynote on your iPad to do that. But that's using this is the distinction. I don't care about using my iPad as a remote. I'm talking about remotely controlling my iPad.
Well, you know, I think the main problem is that you would have to connect them some way, and you probably wouldn't be able to do it via Bluetooth. If the next generation of iPhones and iPads start using the NFC, the near field communication technology,
I just cracked it.
Wait, what is it in my head?
I just thought of it.
Ed First, he's the guest.
We both telekinetically.
Yeah.
Are you guys near field communicating with your brains?
My head almost exploded.
Here's a workaround.
All right.
It's not what we want, but you could have a document on your iPad, for example, on stage. Your stage manager off screen has
a Bluetooth connected keyboard
and just scrolls down for you.
Exactly. Done.
That's exactly what came into my head too.
But what's the radius of a few feet?
I mean, what is it, like 10 feet maybe, Matthew?
No, you can go like 30.
Is it 30?
If it's 30 feet, you could. We did it!
Yay!
We did it!
Yay! Guys, this is how problems get solved.
Here's the bigger.
All right.
Okay.
No, cancer.
Still a problem. This is still an issue.
We just caused more cancer.
No. I thought of why this won't work.
Uh-oh.
Because the stage manager in the wings can't see the screen and has no idea where they are in the document. So if they're scrolling down, they have no idea. They have no idea how far they should be scrolling.
Well, if he wanted to, he could connect the video adapter and he could have his own monitor.
There you go.
There
boom,
it is.
Done.
There it is. Yeah.
That's how you do it.
But the video adapter has to be connected.
You can just stream it down iPad, and then tape down the cords across the stage.
There are cables on the stage anyway.
There's cables on the stage. I'm not worried. The cables, cables we can deal with.
I think that's it.
This would work.
Yeah.
Is there any kind of airplay if he had a monitor? If he had a monitor backstage,
mm-hmm.
could airplay kick? No, because AirPlay only works with it.
Can a Bluetooth keyboard be connected to two different devices?
Is anyone still listening?
No. A lot of people, actually.
Is anyone still listening?
Our audience is all nerds. Are you kidding? Right now, that was just the simultaneous cacophony of 100,000 ejaculations happening at the same time.
Yeah. No, I don't think it's ejaculations. It's people going, the people who knew what to do the entire time.
Right.
That was Alderaan blowing up. That's what you felt.
There's people pacing around the room, like knocking things over, like, I know the answer to this!
You know, when I'm with a lady for a first time, I want her to think I'm really enjoying it. So I have two discharges, and the first one I go pre-cum, and then the second
a lot of pre-cum.
One,
yeah, a lot of big I know pre-cum.
Yeah. Well, I want her to think I'm having a good time. So you know,
how are
ladies,
you?
Ladies like that?
Ladies, why am I? I'm sneezing in here.
Are you allergic?
I've been hitting my cough button. I assume that also works.
I use that for
my burps.
And when I do this,
that's nice. It's like a little Beastie Boys thing. Intergalactic, planetary, intergalactic.
Oh my God, that would be a fucking great bluegrass cover.
Yeah. You're right.
That would be a phenomenal bluegrass cover. Because I love Mike Furman and I did a bluegrass medley of Radiohead covers called Rodeohead, which is just like 18 Radiohead songs.
By the way,
the
Punch Brothers do a completely unironic and phenomenal show of like very beautifully interpreted Radiohead songs.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-oh. And it's actually, I saw it at Telluride Bluegrass Festival last year, and it blew people's minds. It's like a very, very like, intense and very like legit interpretation.
What songs did they cover? Do you remember?
Is that up
anywhere?
I don't think so. It was a live thing. I'm not sure if it's.
Well,
out
if I can't
there.
Find any of those, I'll stick Rodeohead at the end of this broadcast. Broadcast.
But I remember you guys. Yeah, I remember Hard and Firm doing like
with the little blue guy.
You guys.
I remember just how awesome it was when you guys had the backing band video.
Yeah, because we couldn't. It was costing us so much money.
Yeah, like five dudes, right?
We had four or five dudes. We could never play it live, so we literally found one banjo player, a guy named Cody Bryant. We found him, and no one wanted to play. Like every banjo player we'd call, first of all, they all know each other. All the banjo players in LA seemed to know each other because we'd call like the local banjo club,
the banjo hotline.
And they'd be like, no. And then we'd tell them what we wanted to do. And then we'd and they'd go, no, you want this other guy. He plays a 5-string banjo. And they go, no, you need a 4-string banjo with a guy who's heavy on jazz. Because like Radiohead's like 9-8 signature,
right,
you know.
Right.
And so we found one guy who could do it. And we just couldn't keep bringing this whole bluegrass band all around LA. So we shot them in a studio playing a song. And Mike Furman in After Effects put up all this like scrolling news ticker and stuff. And we pretended that we were playing with them live via satellite.
Yeah.
But we put all these dumb non sequitur things at the bottom of the screen. I mean, literally just stuff like sharks are assholes, just like stuff like that.
Yeah, I remember that was great.
And then people would still after the show go, how did you get a satellite link up?
That's like, cool, though.
Really? Sharks are assholes? Yeah. You really think that was on CNN?
Yeah,
so,
I remember thinking that was rad because it was just like through a window, too.
It was through a window.
I never saw that, but that.
It was the only way we could affordably play that song.
And you're booked as that, doing that act on the next Whiskey Sour Radio Hour.
I don't know if we can do it.
Yes.
Did the audio come from that video?
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah.
Yeah, so they play the backing track, and then Mike plays along live, and then we both sing along live.
That's
a
very, very clever solution.
Yeah.
We're just solving all kinds of problems.
There was even the joke up front. I was like, hey guys, how's it going? They're like, hey. You
know, we talked to them and then we go, so to prove this is live, is there anything you have there? And then and then Lee Farber, who writes on The Soup, he goes, oh, I have a newspaper. And I go, what is the date on the newspaper? And he goes, today's. And I go, great. So it's just a stupid workaround, a dumb workaround.
I just remember though, it was timed perfectly. I never saw it even get close to being off sync.
Yeah, we practice, man.
Yeah.
Mike and I just practice in our
doing her homework.
I love, though, because I'm so fat. I adore bluegrass music. I have the Bluegrass Series channel and my presets. I absolutely love it. Was Noam Pickelney.
Noam. He was he's in the Punch Brothers. So he was there Friday night on Friday night's show.
I guess mind-blowing would be the perfect word to describe.
Well, of course, he was on the Whiskey Sour show last year that you did.
And then he won that Bluegrass Award,
Steve Martin Banjo Prize, which is a $50,000 cash prize to someone. There are a lot of these kinds of artistic rewards for in classical music and jazz for musicians who are kind of on the cutting edge and doing something really special. And musicians, as we know, aren't generally making tons of money, especially in fields like bluegrass and jazz. And so, so this is the first award of its kind in the bluegrass world, and it was Steve Martin's idea, and he endowed it, and so Noam won the first one, and they announced it on Letterman. Noam got to play on Letterman, which was very, very cool, and he is a space alien. on the banjo. Like, you cannot believe.
Are Space Aliens known for being really good at the banjo?
Yes. Yeah.
It's one of those Star Trek planets where the entire planet is one central theme.
It's that seventh finger.
So everyone plays. It's just that idea of the universe that every planet is just one thing.
Yeah.
Well, this is a pleasure planet.
Right.
Yeah. This is a banjo planet. So that's where Noam comes from. A really nice guy, too, I remember from last year.
All those guys are great. You know, bluegrass music typically doesn't draw the jerk population.
That's true. Yeah, because it's a very respectful subculture.
Well, I think it's that people are so happy to have found each other. They're kind of like, oh, you like this too?
Let's
be friends.
Beyond that, to play bluegrass music, you have to be good. Like it's not just like, oh, I know three rock chords.
Right.
You know, like you can't, it's very difficult to fake good bluegrass music, I think, because, you know, you're picking a banjo, there's, you know, you're playing a fretless stand-up bass. Or you're playing a mandolin, which is a fucking hard instrument to play. So I think that if you go into bluegrass, you have to be really good.
Well, I may be the exception to that.
That's not true. I saw you play. You're really good. One of my favorite bluegrass bands was a band that was LA based, and they played for years called the Cousin Lovers. And they were fucking phenomenal.
I don't know those guys.
And it was one of those bands that you'd see them live. As my friend Tim Ferguson, and he was a phenomenal a mandolin player. And, you know, I think they have an album called "You're There For Experience," and it's more sort of like contemporary bluegrass. Like the musical themes are contemporary.
Yeah.
But it's just blue. They're just good, solid musicians.
Well, there's a lot. I mean, the word bluegrass can mean so many different things. To some people, it just means a certain arrangement of instruments, banjo, fiddle, bass, guitar, you know, mandolin, and then whatever the music is can be a million different things.
Right.
And a band like the Punch Brothers or the Infamous String Dusters or Crooked Still, like all these cool bands are kind of like redefining what that instrument cluster can produce.
What are the how many ties does bluegrass music have to just Irish kind of like, you know, picky
you know, I don't I think the ancestry of bluegrass music is more of the sort of Scottish hill country music. Yeah. That, you know, Appalachian, the Scottish settlers in Appalachia that kind of got mixed with American you know, spirit gospel music,
yeah,
and things
yeah.
like that. But there's no question a lot of Irish, there's a lot of players that kind of cross into both categories that play Irish and play bluegrass, and especially fiddle players overlap. But
I remember last year, not only was the main show that we did super fun, but then you guys went to the Little Room at Largo.
Oh, yeah.
And fucking jammed. You jammed with Sarah Watkins and Jackson Brown.
Yeah.
Like Jackson Brown was there, and then he went up and you guys just jammed.
That was, those Little Room jams are the greatest. That's one of the coolest things about Largo is the community that just kind of like bubbles up out of the woodwork, and everyone just loves to hang out and play great music.
I mean, that, you know, Flanagan is such a genius and such a sweet guy, the guy who runs Largo. That Largo is really the hub of like some of the best comedy and music. I mean, like, you know, you saw you know, this is where guys like Paul F. Tompkins and Sarah Silverman and Posehn and Patton and Zach and Mitch Hedberg and like a lot of these people flourished at Largo in the 90s.
And musically, it was like Elliott Smith and
Amy Mann
and Fiona Apple and
Grantley Phillips.
And of course, Nickel Creek and those guys, you know, the Watkins and
Rufus Wainwright. And I mean, like, it's just an incredible hub of comedy and music. And I like that they're so sort of closely related. Like, all these musicians, John Bryan, they're all, like, funny people.
Yeah.
Like, they're genuinely funny people.
That's why I thought it was perfect when Loudon Wainwright III did a couple shows at Largo, like, maybe about, like, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty spot on, just because it's, you know, comedy, and he's so funny.
How does 10-year-old Ed Helms wrap his mind around playing banjo with Steve Martin?
10-year-old Ed Helms? What do you mean?
Maybe not.
Like 11 and a half.
I guess it'd be like...
You mean like...
Like you're, as you as a kid, you know, like because I imagine that you were probably a Steve Martin fan.
I was a Steve Martin fan, but a huge Steve Martin fan. But oddly, my bluegrass trajectory kind of was separate from my. I loved Steve Martin as a comedian, and I always thought that it was really cool that he played the banjo. But you know, bluegrass music for me kind of. I don't know. I got into it through different channels. So now what was really cool for me and kind of a privilege in the last couple of years is getting to know Steve Martin through our mutual love of banjo music and not through comedy. Like something that I think you would think is what drew us together is this sort of common career that we share. But really it's actually this other interest that we have.
My guess is that Steve Martin does not want to talk about comedy. He probably only wants to talk about banjo. That
and
clearly
art.
Seems to be his passion.
He just wants to talk about art and banjo.
He does like to talk about art. He's just a really inspired and like passionate guy. And he's an incredible songwriter. He's put these two albums out in the last couple of years that are jaw-dropping.
It was the one from a year or two ago?
The Crow.
The Crow. Yeah. That one's great. I picked that one up when I was at the banjo museum in Oklahoma City.
That's just a beautiful, wonderful tune. And I actually had the privilege of playing it with him this last Sunday night as our closing night of the...
And find an artistic endeavor that Steve Martin's not good at.
I know he's a genius.
Glass blowing.
All right,
we stumped.
You'd
him.
Be surprised. You'd be surprised.
Well, you know what though? He's experienced balloon animal shaper.
Oh, that's right.
Glass blowing.
Yeah, that's right.
Your lower intestines.
I still get giddy when I see Steve Martin tweeting at Albert Brooks and Albert Brooks tweeting back at Steve Martin. Still just
what a world
me.
We live in.
Yeah, now. Right? We get to hear the conversation between two comedy giants.
They both tweeted at me once, and it's not because they have any idea who I am, because they tweet back to a lot of people. But I still, like, I felt that. As soon as I saw that I got a tweet from Albert Brooks, I felt like I was about to evacuate my balls. Yeah. I mean, my balls.
Your balls.
My bowels.
Wait, freak them.
Where do you keep your
you
balls?
You know what? Fuck it. I'll evacuate. Bowels. I'll tell you what. Albert Brooks get balls and bowels. How about that?
Yeah.
It's just everything evacuates so I can prepare for flight to run around in circles and scream. Yeah. But it is such an interesting time where, I mean, when we were younger, we had these, you know, I had these comedy legends like Steve Martin or George Carlin or Richard Pryor. And there was little to no chance that we would ever be able to communicate with these people. And now I don't know if people really understand, especially the younger generation of folks, what a gift it is that you can actually communicate with people that you idolize. Mm.
I don't know. It's a gift, but it's also kind of terrifying.
Like can you say it's a curse?
Well, because can I say it's a curse?
Yes, it's a gift, but it's also a curse.
It's a gift. It's a gift, but also a curse.
Oh,
it's a curse.
Vertigo.
But you know, because there's something when everyone has a voice, a lot of toxic stuff gets out there too, and that's kind of a creepy thing.
Mostly toxic stuff.
Mostly toxic stuff.
Comments
gets out there.
When you only care enough to say the very worst. That's Neil Mahoney.
I guess that is true. I mean, you're on Twitter. You're Edward Helms. Right?
Yeah, but I'm sort of on it, but not really. I don't know. I haven't really gotten into it.
Yeah,
I'm a little. I don't know. Kind of like a private person. I don't like any of you people at all.
Well, that just came out though.
<That's fair. laughs> Let me tweet that. I don't like any of you. No, I
the
just
elephant in the room.
I sort of. I don't know. I like to have, feel like I still have a little bubble of privacy or something.
Yeah. But I think
but maybe Twitter. Maybe I'm overthinking it. Like Twitter doesn't necessarily violate that. It's just kind of like putting every.
It's what you want to show.
I mean, it's not like if I have a fight with my girlfriend, it's not like I go on Twitter and go, I had this really intense conversation with, you know, like.
I know, but when I had a fight with your girlfriend, I tweeted about it.
That was some funny tweets.
Yeah, some of my best work.
She just wished that you had shouted pre-cum the first time on the little preview. But I want to know, where did you grow up and where did you start comedy? And, you know, was it something that you pursued as a kid or how did it all?
I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia. And
you mean Hotlanta?
Hotlanta.
Don't say that. That pisses people off.
ATL?
Yeah, ATL.
Can I say ATL?
Yeah, the 404.
Can I say the Hustle and Flow? He's from the Hustle and Flow.
Let him talk.
What's the 404?
Isn't that Atlanta?
Oh, 404 area code, yeah, of course. Yeah. Grew up there and then went off to college in Ohio, Oberlin College. And I just always wanted to be doing comedy on TV. There was something about all those shows like, you know, Saturday Night Live and Seinfeld. And when I was a teenager, a young teenager, the Ha Network, which was what eventually became Comedy mm-hmm. Central, was on. And I was obsessed with that. I watched the stand-up specials. There wasn't a lot of content to show on that channel
time. And a lot of it was kind of Canadian.
It was like a lot. You're right. Yeah. There was a lot of like weird stand-up video. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't even call it like specials. It was just stuff that they had like cobbled together.
They were just sort of raping the comedy boom from the 80s for material because you had the Hot Channel and then Comedy Channel.
And it was a lot of like Paul Provenza and all these great, you know, the guys that sort of set up where we are now. And I just just drank that stuff up. I couldn't get enough. And of course, the Kids in the Hall on HBO at the time was so formative for me. Yeah. I just wanted, and Saturday Night Live, I just wanted to be like in that universe. So when I graduated from college, I moved to New York City and I had another job for a couple of years before I realized, you know, I sort of said to myself, you know the reason you moved to New York City was to do comedy, right?
Isn't it interesting how people forget that? Because they just get so caught up in like, I got to pay my bills.
It's not just that. It's like there's a lot of fear. You know, like I think for me, it was a matter of kind of getting over the fear of failure, you know, which, of course, I've never really lost. I think we all struggle with that. But it's like if I didn't try comedy, I could never fail at it. So it was sort of like I could always say, oh, I could have done comedy unless I did it and failed, in which case. Does this make any sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So then I eventually kind of just came to terms with that, and I was like, if I'm going to do this, I got to do it. It's time to do it.
And how did you do it? Did you keep a day job? Did you do comedy at night? Did you do stuff at UCB?
I did. I sort of kept a day job. Actually, around that time, I had started doing reasonably well in the voiceover kind of racket, which is commercial voiceovers for TV commercials and radio commercials and all that stuff. And so I started to make a livable wage doing that. So my days were fairly flexible. I'd have like four or five auditions, voiceover auditions all day long, all over New York City. Mm-hmm. And then at night I was just in all those clubs until 2 or 3 in the morning every night. And it was sort of like, I just made the decision like every time there's a microphone that someone will allow me to talk into in front of an audience, I'm gonna get there. And so it was, those 4, 5, 6, 7 years of that, just mm-hmm. kind of going out every night. And it was really awesome.
Did you go on the road at all?
You know, I was sort of more of New York City based comic. I did a little bit of road stuff, some colleges, and then like a lot of New York comedians, the tri-state area, you kind of like bounce out to Long Island and up in Connecticut.
It's such a good place if you start, you know, there's sort of like feeder communities are a little bit smaller, like, oh, you know, actually Atlanta has a decent comedy scene, Denver has a good comedy scene, then you move to like San Francisco or Chicago, then you can migrate to New York.
Right.
But I always tell people like, don't come to LA first because it's not a good place.
It's a bad place to start.
I kind of was methodical about it. I thought, you know, to me it was either Los Angeles and like, you know, try to get into the Groundlings and kind of go that route, or go to Chicago and really try to work my way into the Second City world. Or go to New York City and try to kind of go it alone as a stand-up comedian. And I felt like that's where I could just have more of an impact. And actually, I think also doing stand-up comedy, you have a little more control of your destiny. It's a more entrepreneurial endeavor than just going and joining an existing entity.
It also makes you feel like you have control over what you're doing. Right. I mean, there were spans of a few years where I didn't work, but I always felt like at least I'm moving forward in some way because I have stand-up to do,
right?
And I can do that every night, and that's up to me.
Right.
And so I always felt like I'm a little more in control of my destiny than just, you know, like just auditioning for stuff as an actor.
And when you're a stand-up, it's a, you're not like an improv kid where we were saying you have to identify yourself with an entire group or a theater or anything like that. You're just kind of your own comedic entity.
Yeah,
you
don't, exactly.
No one will say it's like, well, he's a UCB kid. You know, no one can say that. They could just say, oh, well, he's just a comic.
That's that's where I think comedy, stand-up comedy is such a cool kind of, I don't know, exciting thing because you can, if you work really hard, you will get better and better and better, mm-hmm. and you're the one who gets the credit for that. It's also, on the flip side, when you are tanking and when you're failing, there's no one to sort of blame.
But I kind of like that. I kind of like having full responsibility for it.
Yeah, that's what I liked about it. Was like it was me. It was on my terms, and I was either working or bombing because of me. And I could sort of it was exciting to me to kind of own that responsibility.
And I also love the sort of free fall of, like, if you're in a scene with someone, if you're doing a sketch and it's not going over, you're in that sketch until it's done.
Right.
You know, but at least with stand-up, you can make those quick decisions or talk to the crowd or, you know, like, you literally are just this weird comedy wizard.
You control
everything.
Unless you're in the middle of, like, a story or, like, a longer bit, then it's hard to just bail up.
But what's interesting is that I wrote an article for Wired last year about comedy writing.
Oh, boy.
And I talked
plug.
To... I don't know if it's available anywhere, like the internet. But Bob Newhart, I got Bob Newhart to submit something, and what he said he does is his stories have a series of bailout points. So he has pre-placed a series of bailout points throughout the story.
That's great.
And he just goes through the story until it's not working anymore.
That's perfect.
And then he jumps out, and then he goes home and then tries to figure out how to get past to the next bailout point. It's almost like it's almost like pole position, that old video. It's like, oh, I got to get to the next checkpoint.
Right.
So like, it was a genius. I never thought of it that way before, but it was a really genius way to do it.
I guess I think if you have the right kind of energy, you can really bail out of anything at any point.
Always know where your exits are.
Yes. But the cool thing about stand-up in New York City was that the comedy community, at least kind of when I was there, this is about 10 years ago, I guess I'm talking about, mm-hmm. between, I don't know, 14 and 12 years ago, that little stretch. It was such everyone was in it together. There was this feeling of like all the improv guys, UCB had just started, and everyone was kind of psyched about Upright Citizens Brigade, and it was starting to make its mark, and comedians hung out with improv comedy people, sketch comedy people. Everyone hung out together. There was a bar in Chelsea that everyone hung out. That was literally like Cheers for
McManus.
McManus. And that 19th sense and of that sense of community was so exciting, and I feel so privileged to have been a part of that at that time, because I don't know what it's like now, but there was an excitement and an energy and something that felt like everyone was in it together and kind of rooting for each other, and that's why I think that's kind of what gave me a sense of like I'm in the right place, mm-hmm. because in that world, like, friends of mine were starting to get auditions for, you know, The Daily Show or Saturday Night Live or sitcoms or whatever it was, and people were doing, a lot of our friends in that crew were doing bits on Conan and becoming writers on Conan and things like that. So it kind of felt like this little farm league and a good crew, and it was a really exciting four or five years there.
So what was your first kind of big, what was your first job where you were like, oh, I think this actually is going to change things a little bit?
Well, there was, I guess, a lot of, you kind of can mark your progress in stand-up just by the time slots you're getting at different comedy clubs, you know what I mean? Like, if you're getting more of the kind of primetime spots. And I didn't really crack the nut of New York City stand-up. I wasn't like a main featured guy at like the Comedy Cellar or the Comic Strip.
Right.
But I was getting, you know, at some of the lesser clubs, I was getting good spots, but also a lot of the regular, the kind of shows that comedians put together mm-hmm. around town. I was doing a lot of those and just in sort of bars and whatnot. But
I always find those to be the most fun.
Those can be a lot of fun. They can also be the worst.
Yeah.
The absolute worst.
Because sometimes yeah. those shows.
It's comedy in general, though.
You know, like people don't know that there's about to be a comedy show.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden the microphone.
Right,
goes
exactly.
Up. It's like, can I have everyone's attention, please?
No, I'm hitting on this girl at the bar.
Sir,
shut
please.
Up,
please, sir.
Comedian.
Later, I want to tell you about how crazy it is to eat cereal.
Hold on. Let me turn off this football game everyone seems to be into and let's start the jokes.
Room seems to be haunted.
There was one show I did actually, the first tour I did, if you could call it that, it wasn't even a tour, it was just a trip to Santa Fe I took with Dimitri Martin and this guy William Mullen and Karen Bergreen, and we all we played at this piano bar in Santa Fe, and I just remember the piano player at this piano bar, which this bar was like an institution in Santa Fe, and he was so angry that the comedians were playing. It was very passive aggressive towards us. It was really fun, though.
Well, when comedy comes, hey, I don't fucking bring my piano into your comedy club.
Exactly, yeah. But anyway, to answer your question, I think the first thing that made me feel like, all right, this is maybe I'm doing something right here, was Premium Blend, mm-hmm. which was an early...
I did Premium Blend in 2001.
Yeah.
I remember it.
Yeah, that's about the time I did it. Or no, I did it in 2002.
Okay.
You did it, yeah. Because I had actually, in between the time that I was booked on Premium Blend and when I actually did Premium Blend, I also got hired on The Daily Show.
Right.
So I was I had become a Daily Show correspondent, and then I went and did a Premium Blend set. I guess that was... of course, The Daily Show was a major kind of...
I mean, you felt the impact of that right away.
Kind of yes and no. I mean, it was a tremendous validation of years of kind of being in the trenches. But on the other hand, you don't really get a sense of permanence there for quite a while.
Right.
You know, there's a trial period. And so I kind of felt a little bit on eggshells for a while. But... but eventually settled in and yeah.
What was the audition process like for The Daily Show? Did they just come out and see you do a set, or did you have to prepare like
a
piece?
At that time, the Comedy Central talent person, I was just on her radar, and as a stand-up comedian, so she was aware of me, and then they had this big cattle call audition, and I don't know, a couple hundred people came in, I think, at that time. And it was you literally just reading a segment, a teleprompted segment from the show.
Oh, wow.
Just as a stand-up reporter. But it was a segment I had already seen on the show. I watched the show religiously. So I had seen Colbert do this exact segment. And then it's my audition piece. And I was like, all right, I'll knock this out of the park. I know exactly how you want it. And that was the first round, and then there was a callback where about 10 of us went into the studio and actually did that same piece
mm-hmm.
In the studio with Jon Stewart, and then sat at the desk with Jon and did a little chat segment with him too.
Oh, that's cool.
And and that was it. And that was in that round is when Rob Corddry and I were hired at the exact same time. Yeah.
Oh, that must have been that must have been fun. I mean, that's like when The Daily Show was just popped. Like right there, really, that's kind of when it blew up.
You know what? Yeah. To me, it popped from the very beginning. I was like, even when Craig Kilborn was a host, I was obsessed with it.
Kilborn!
I thought it was a great...
Blah, 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 blah. Here's the joke! Craig Kilborn.
But I loved it, even because it started when I was in college, and I was just like, this is a really special, cool show. That
yeah.
it's about damn time someone started doing this.
I remember because Doug Herzog, who went to run Comedy Central, he left MTV to go run Comedy Central, and so I was working at MTV at the time, and he went over to Comedy Central, and I just went and had lunch with him or something, and he was like, yeah, we're going to develop this... this kind of like daily show. This is sort of like a daily news kind of show.
You know what's funny is that the name The Daily Show was so ironic when it was named that. That was a joke. the name The Daily Show was a meta joke because no one called itself what The it Daily Show. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right.
It's like calling something The Morning Show. It just doesn't. And it had like ironic value, but it's lost it over time. Now yeah. it's just become this proper noun, The Daily
Show. The Daily Show.
And everyone accepts it for
it's
what
it's a label,
is.
Like
and
Kleenex.
Yeah. And it's lost its kind of irony.
Even Colbert Report, which is his fucking name.
Right.
Yeah, it just sounds like it's just a thing. Right. Colbert Report.
Right. It's now it's so funny how these things just kind of get, you know, they get grooved into our neural networks as like normal. But when it started, it was this
neural networks. Yeah. It's pre-com. I love that tech talk.
I still can't hear the Daily Show theme without thinking about the episode that Bill Murray was on. It was like one of the five questions was like, "Can you make lyrics to the Daily Show theme song?" He was just like, "Yeah." Why won't you watch it? It's the Daily Show. Come on and watch it. It's the Daily Show. And then everyone's like, "Oh fuck!
Oh my god! He did it!"
Now I can't help but hear it every
this
time.
This is one of my greatest memories of that theme is backstage before the show. If I was on the show and Colbert was also on the show, he would do this thing where when the theme played in the studio, he would pretend like he was a trumpet player and he would be backstage just like, you know, like warming up his fingers and stuff, waiting for the music to start. And then, and then the announcer would come on, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Daily Show." And then the theme starts, and he would put the trumpet up to his mouth like he was going to play. And then the guitars kick in, and he'd bring the trumpet down. Like, wait, it's supposed to be my trumpet part. He'd get all indignant. It's so funny.
Every time, right? They do it every time.
Colbert pantomime bits, just genius.
Does he drop character before he goes on, or does he pretty much become the character of the public character of Stephen Colbert?
No, I think everyone's in character pretty much when the camera's rolling, and then
everyone's cool please only address me in character.
Right.
Stephen Colbert.
Well, if you want to talk to Ed Helms, you're going to have to wait a few minutes.
Wait, is this Ed Helms now or is it the other Ed Helms
to? This is Daily Show Ed Helms. I'll be back in a minute. Let me just go in this closet.
Stretch. And then so how did was The Office, cuz you know, obviously being a fan of the original Office, America has this really interesting pattern of we don't have a strong success rate with trying to convert British shows, because I always feel like, you know, like we speak the same word language, but there are so many subtextual things that are culturally that make us just different enough that things that work over in England don't necessarily work over here.
I call it the coupling conundrum.
The coupling conundrum. Yeah. Which was a Stephen Moffat show, which Stephen Moffat wrote on. And they tried to make coupling work like three seasons in a row here in America. The coupling was a huge, huge British sitcom. Every year they would bring it back for like 3 years and they could never get it to work. And so it never made it past the pilot. So when The Office was coming to America, I think I kind of had this snotty comedy prejudice of like, oh my God, what the fuck?
Right.
And you guys totally made it your own show. I mean, it was an incredible feat that you have a completely separate show. And when most people talk about The Office in America now, they are generally not referring to the British version.
Yeah. Well, that's a real testament to Greg Daniels, who the showrunner who created the American version, and Steve, obviously.
Yeah.
I remember when I was a fan of the British show. Ricky Gervais is just genius.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard it was coming over, I actually auditioned for the part of Jim.
Really?
You can believe it. Yeah. Wow. I remember going up to the NBC offices and auditioning in New York. When I heard that it was coming over, and I heard that Carell was going to be the Ricky Gervais character, I a lot of people like you were kind of like, oh boy, here we go. But I actually was 100% confident that it was going to crush, because I was such a fan of Carell's.
Yeah.
And we overlapped just a tiny bit on The Daily Show, like 2 months or something, and had really only met a couple of times. He was back and forth to L.A., at the time, I think doing that Julia Louis-Dreyfus show, mm-hmm. Watching Ellie. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
I think, wasn't he on that or something else before that? Anyway, so he was sort of not around that much when I was on The Daily Show. And then he officially left around the time yeah, when the office got going. So, but I was so amped for it, and then of course they delivered, and
really
it just
did.
Became something great. And then I waited for it to win an Emmy, and I was like, oh, I'll join that show.
They've been asking you since the beginning. Come on, Ed. Come on the show.
Let me just see how it does.
Yeah, wait till you win an Emmy.
Let me see if it works out.
That's when
okay.
You'll get.
It's, yeah, you guys. It's Ed.
Yeah, you'll do.
Hey, Greg. It's Ed. Yeah.
You'll do. I'll take it.
I'll come on your show.
I'll come
now.
On.
I mean, how much is there? How much is there? A lot of improvising on the set, or is it? I mean, because it seems very organic. It just seems like a lot of organic comedy
in. In TV, you don't have the same time flexibility that you do on a movie set sometimes. So there is a lot of improvisation, but it's very contained. Like mm-hmm. it doesn't spin out into kind of like, you know, crazy directions or new rants and stuff.
A separate scene doesn't develop.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, you're not going to like improvise something and then afterwards be like, now we have to shoot this because you guys said that. Yeah. It doesn't work like that at all. Whereas in movies, that can happen. Like you'll improvise something, it'll go crazy, and you might make adjustments down the road because you have the sort of flexibility in the schedule or in the production. So on The Office, we improvise, but it's really contained and you still have to hit the beats of a scene. Mm-hmm. So we can kind of stay on schedule. And it also depends on we have, you know, a different director for almost every show. So it kind of depends on their vibe and how they direct. And
yeah.
And it also, if we are in a time crunch, you can't really improvise.
Right.
Because you just don't have time. Because improvising it's indulgent and it takes time.
Oh, and if it doesn't work.
And a lot of times it doesn't
work.
That
is a weenie shrinker.
You're wasting all the film you're shooting on.
Everyone's time, all the other actors.
Yeah. But the scripts are so good. The writing staff at The Office is so extraordinary that you don't need to.
Yeah.
You don't need to improvise. And that's why when we do improvise, it tends to be little kind of one-off lines and little kind of spin-off directions here and there, but not like a huge kind of redirect of a scene.
Yeah.
So
now that Carell's leaving, man, no one's really called me yet to fill in for him. I don't know. Did they say anything
yes.
to you?
Yeah.
Okay.
They did.
Oh, good.
They said that when I told them I was coming to do this show, they said, will you ask Chris?
Oh, good. Yeah.
To stop calling us.
Oh, okay. Okay. Oh, they may want my agent to call.
Oh, yeah, right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's
right.
Probably what they mean.
Yeah.
You want to keep it official.
Yeah, just have the agent or the manager call to, I mean, it's I'm sure it's a bummer to see Steve Carell go, but I mean, like, when you talk about a show that has such a solid cast of characters, I don't think the show is going to suffer one bit in terms of people not enjoying the show. I think it's, I mean, you guys have built such a great stable of people to watch.
I mean, that's really gracious, Chris. And I happen to agree. We have an incredible cast on that show. And the loss of Steve is sort of catastrophic in one way. But on the other hand, it's just like a rebirth. It's an incredibly exciting new, I don't know, like a new reinvention of this
Peter
show.
Gabriel left Genesis.
Exactly. And we got Shock the Monkey.
Even more success.
It's a fucking great song.
Or we got Phil Collins in Genesis.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. No, I'm sorry. I went the Peter Gabriel route.
Yeah. No, let's not do that.
Yeah. Land of
Never
Confusion.
Never go the Peter Gabriel route.
We got Illegal Alien.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's a no fun being an illegal alien.
Oh, I'm saying. But we also got Phil Collins and Philip Bailey. She's an easy lover. When you just saw the fun side of Phil Collins just fucking around with Philip Bailey of Earth, Wind, and Fire. Oh, those were good times. So Hangover. I mean, Hangover was one of those movies that really kind of redefined the next generation of comedy films being made because
I'll tell you
exactly why, because it was, I mean, you guys were all known, but film works like film people don't know who TV people are generally, like film studio executives
right.
don't really know who TV people are, and they don't generally treat TV. I mean, I've had tons of friends on TV shows and they're not treated very respectfully by studio people, who tend to think it's this old, you know, pre-Vatican II idea of television and film, which is like, a film is classy and television is for the plebs.
Yeah,
like
he's a real up-and-comer. He's been the lead of a TV show for about 5 years, but he's on his way up.
You know, so to get three guys that weren't huge superstars yet to basically drive a film was kind of a big, well, I think, kind of a big deal.
I think the big deal was this like utterly shocking juggernaut that it became, because there is a history of making, it wasn't a big movie. Like the budget wasn't huge. It wasn't like this massive risk for the studio. You know, it's not like they put unknown guys in, you know, a giant Terminator scale blockbuster.
Right.
It was a relatively low end in the budget sort of scale of things. It was relatively small. And I think, you know, Todd Phillips, God bless him, fought really hard to get the three of us in there and to be the central characters and convinced Warner Brothers that we wouldn't ruin it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess it's the phenomenon became what was just this response that no one predicted.
Right. I mean, literally, like I was at a Comic-Con in Chicago a month ago, and to see dudes walking around dressed up like your characters, it was so. I mean, it's awesome, but at the same time, it's like, holy shit, that's like just to see how much it's permeated culture.
It's funny, like just that blacking out that tooth.
Yeah,
I saw a lot of people at Halloween. Like, it's a very easy costume. You just put on like a gray polo and black out your tooth and glasses, and then of course a baby Bjorn and a beard, all of a sudden you're Zach.
Yeah, I don't know how anyone could pretend to be Bradley Cooper though. That's a weird.
They just got to be first devastatingly handsome.
Yeah.
Oh no, it's easy. You go to the gym 6 hours a day for 9 years.
You go home and have sex with every A-list actress.
When I like bring up Bradley Cooper, I don't have to go, you know, that guy from that one Stella sketch that I really like.
The guy that was with Amy Poehler in Wet Hot American Summer. You know the guy.
You know the guy who was in Wedding Crashers, who played the asshole.
He was great.
He was really great in Wedding Crashers.
But he is extraordinary. You know what? I think Bradley's eyes are so striking that if they made like a Bradley Cooper brand contact lens.
Yep.
Anyone on earth could put in those contact lenses and people would be like, Bradley? Are you Bradley?
Piercing, the new fragrance by Bradley Cooper. He seems like a nice, funny dude.
The greatest. And it's a pretty incredible little crew.
So were you excited to go work with all of your friends again on the second go around, or was any part of you like, oh fuck, we did this so well the first time and now, you know, like there are expectations, or like what was your mindset going into the second movie?
You know, we talked about it a lot when the concept of doing a sequel first came up.
Probably after the first weekend. Right?
It was very soon, but it didn't really, you know, the it was brought up very soon after it opened, but it didn't really become real for a couple months after that. But then when the conversation really got real, we all talked about it, and it was funny what we arrived at. Certainly in my head, it's hard to make a movie. It takes many, many months of hard work, and you're in the trenches with people. And what the movie is at the end of the day is a two-hour experience for an audience, and that's kind of, hopefully it's wonderful. But when you're on the production side of it, making the movie, you really have to weigh what that experience is going to be like when you make these choices, because that's really how, as an actor, you're spending your life. You're burning the wick of your life, like working on these things. And you can either kind of like, if you have the option of working with wonderful people and that you love and are psyched to work with, and you feel like you can make a good product with, that's almost more important at the end of the day than what the product might be.
Mm-hmm. Some of that you have no control over.
Yeah. So we kind of like, we were all on the same page that we just were psyched to work together again. And that sort of made the decision easy. And then, but you know, there was also like, well, the script has to be there. Like, we have to have a
Were you involved in that, in the script process at all?
There was a lot of kind of back and forth with the whole gang about sort of what the ideas might be. But really, really it was Todd and Scott Armstrong and Craig Mazin who just sort of went off and created that beautiful babe.
Yeah, Scott's going to be on the podcast in June. We're going to him on. Yeah.
Yeah, Scott's a dear old friend. I actually met Todd Phillips through Scott.
Oh, that's cool.
At Scott's wedding, as a matter of fact. Charleston, South Carolina.
Oh, wow. Well, good friend. You went all the way to South Carolina.
Yeah.
God damn it, South Carolina. I got to fucking fly to South Carolina.
I've known Scott for a very long time just through Upright Citizens Brigade shenanigans in New York.
That's what's so fun about, I mean, like... You know, I always sometimes hear stories about like, oh, there was so much drama on this set and there was this, which was pain in the ass. But my favorite thing is to sort of watch our community of comic friends all start to kind of take their places and get more known and show people what we already knew about them. You know, like that part is always very exciting to me.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, you're right. It's fun. It's fun to watch your peers kind of bubble up and. You're right. It's like when we know someone's awesome and we're rooting for them.
Yeah. And like, it's almost selfishly, it's almost validating. Like, I knew it.
Yeah.
I always knew that guy was really funny and I'm not an idiot because now everyone else sees how funny he is. It's a pretty cool, fun thing to experience. And I think Hangover 2 is going to do phenomenally well.
I'm going to quote you on that. I'm gonna hold you to that.
As I said to Tom Lennon on Saturday, there's not a dollar in this country that movie won't make.
Yeah.
I really want Todd Phillips to get to a point where he has like a huge movie coming out and says from the guy who made hated the Gigi Allen documentary. We'll go, oh yeah, yeah, okay, we should go see that movie about that rock and roller dude that threw shit at people.
And I also want to let people, oh, do you ever want to do stand up again? Like, is stand up a kind of thing that, because obviously if you wanted to tour now, you could fill very large rooms.
Well, I do it as a little sort of segment of the Whiskey Sour Radio Hour.
Yeah.
And I do little bits here and there. I'll jump on like a friend's show at Largo now and then. But what I found, especially after I got on The Daily Show, is that to do stand-up well and to be psyched about it and to have fun doing it, you have to be doing it regularly.
Yeah.
And to just pop in every 6 months and do a set is actually just blood-curdlingly terrifying. and it's just not as fun because you're not in the rhythm. You're not in your sort of voice is like your comedic voice is a little more kind of unprocessed at that point. But
and then it puts you off for another 6 months. So you're like, it wasn't very fun. And then you miss it.
But I do have fun every time I do it. And I do. So I guess there is this thing in the back of my head. Like I would like to do more of it. I miss it. I certainly miss those times in New York City.
There really is nothing else that can substitute for a good stand-up set.
Yep.
No matter what you do, and I would imagine, you know, the more famous people get, the kind of scarier it is, because if people have a certain expectation, you know, like, oh, that guy's always going to be funny all the time. You know, when you're seeing really good edited work together, like your best takes, and you're always super funny, and then it's like, oh no, this is a process. Some of these jokes may not work. This is just part of how stand up works, you guys.
Hey, audience, work with me here.
Come on, you guys.
But there's a flip side to that too, which is that if you're known, then people are coming to see you hopefully because they like you already.
Right.
So there's like sometimes audiences can be really warm and receptive and give you a little more leeway.
Yes.
Way. I don't know. It's hard. My schedule has been pretty bananas between the off. Like when I'm in production on The Office, it's like I can't do anything. I can't really think about much outside work, be it stand up or whatever else. So.
I also want to tell people that if they have not seen Cedar Rapids, they should see Cedar Rapids.
Hey, thanks.
I saw the screening that you had, and it was great. I mean, such a fun movie.
Thank you.
And I love Steven Root.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I don't think you can still see that movie anywhere.
It's not like on iTunes or
yeah,
Netflix.
You know what? It should be bubbling up in those outlets.
It's a really fun movie that I think people should go see.
Very proud of that. Very extremely proud of it. John C. Reilly delivers what I think is his most hilarious performance of all time. He's so heartbreaking in that movie. He's so sad. Kurtwood Smith and I have a nude scene together.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Kurtwood Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Just give me my fucking phone call.
That's from RoboCop. I would just be quoting RoboCop to Kurtwood Smith the whole time.
Believe me, I was so psyched that
bitches leave.
Oh God. I loved him in RoboCop.
What a weird choice for a villain he was. Like, aesthetically, what an insanely great and completely different kind of choice. Like, this kind of creepy-looking, sneering, bald guy.
Yeah. Clarence Boddicker.
Clarence Boddicker, you're good coming one. With me.
The best part, I remember watching that on VHS as a kid and rewinding on my VHS machine the scene where the guy stumbles out of the toxic waste.
Yes.
And gets hit by the car.
Yeah.
It's completely exposed. And it's an amazing, if you slow it down and watch it like frame for frame, the special effects makeup that they did on the guy coming out of the toxic waste thing is glorious.
That guy his name is Paul. He lives near me, so I see him all
Which
the time.
Guy? The guy that was in the toxic waste?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I always say hi to him.
He like his face is dripping off and like it's such a gory movie. Cool.
Yeah, it really like just that movie just captured this just satirized the sort of post Cold War nuclear age of just like what like where conceivably towns should like cities should have gone in 10 or 15 years from the 80s.
Detroit's not far off.
Yeah, that's why they need that statue.
Yeah, this is the RoboCop statue.
Yeah.
OCP.
Is that real?
They're trying to get. There's a campaign to try to get a RoboCop statue put up in Detroit.
Oh, yeah. I'm for it.
Yeah, I'm for it too. That. But Ed Helms, we've taken up enough of your time. But I do want to say thank you. You know, you're one of those guys that if somehow like my head was up my ass and I hadn't seen some of the biggest thing our culture has to offer, like The Office and the Hangover series, that I would just never guess. Like, oh, Ed's a big famous comedian. Like, you're just such a nice guy. Like, it's always nice to hang out with you. So thank
Fuck
you for
you, Chris.
Yeah, see,
I beg to.
I'm going to rape your face, Chris Hardwick.
That's also, real. Thank you.
And
that's
also, as a Kids in the Hall fan, I just thought I would bring out my Kevin McDonald impersonation.
Very
just to
good.
Say, oh, thank you very much, Ed Helms. I've been working on it for quite a long time. I don't know
that's
why.
That's really good.
That's really the only impersonation I do.
You don't do a Bruce McCullough?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, there's a little bit of that guy.
All right.
But it's not as good. It's not as good as my Kevin McDonald.
Can I just reference my favorite Kids in the Hall sketch of all time?
Please.
Please.
The guy, the hunters.
The suits!
The suit hunters.
I knew it.
they paddle a canoe through the office.
So genius.
And they trap businessmen in bear traps and then take their suits and sell them to a haberdasher.
But first they club the businessmen rather than just taking their clothes off. They fucking club them.
Oh my God.
We have some fine selections for you today, Armani.
This one was brave, and like he chewed his leg off.
Right. That was very similar to the one where they like
steel toe boots.
Where the kid finds a businessman, and like he adopts it like a pet. Yeah. He's like, no, we need to let him go, honey. He needs to live with. There's something wrong with Mr. Jenkins. God damn it, that show.
And the theme song to that show was
Shadowy Man on a Shadowy Planet.
Yeah, it just had such a great vibe. And the opening credits, like that nostalgic black and white stuff. Yeah. That was a just genius show.
I forget which episode of it, but it's a Mystery Science Theater episode where it's just like a shot of like a car just driving along the street, like just the stuff going by, and then like I think Mike Nelson just is like, he's like, it's Kids in the Hall. And I just remember going like, oh, they all
they're
know.
Crossing over. They're crossing over.
Mystery Science Theater, the Gizmonic Institute.
Gizmonic Institute.
Yep. Most brilliant name for an institute ever.
Oh God.
D13.
I got it. Those are all on Netflix. They're the old.
A lot of them are.
But all of the Kids in the Halls are on Netflix. So if you are out there listening to this and you're a kid in high school or something, go watch all the Kids in the Halls.
So what else is there? Anything else that that you have coming out that you want to promote besides what's going to be the hugest movie in America or Cedar Rapids Hangover 2?
Oh, I'm going to be hosting Saturday Night Live on May 14th.
What?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Dude, you haven't done that before, have you?
No.
Are you freaking out?
Completely.
Have they talked? Do you know what you're going to do yet? Have you talked to them?
I have not stopped shitting my pants since I heard.
I have noticed.
That would explain the microphone fart sounds from earlier.
Yeah. That's exactly.
Oh, my God. That's huge.
I'm beyond psyched.
You coming in with ideas? Have you been starting to write any ideas?
I have written the entire show already.
Oh, good. And, guys, here's what we're going to do.
Here are your lines, everybody.
I emailed it to Lorne Michaels. And
so I see this as a 90-minute one-person show about a young man's journey from adolescence through what I would call superstardom.
Right, right.
So
I've been planning to be on the show for 20 years. And as such, I've written parts for everybody. Yeah, exactly. I've actually.
Church ladies in there.
I've called past cast members. They're all who I like. They're all coming back.
Can we get Murphy's returning? Denitra Vance?
Denitra Vance.
No, I'm just psyched I can't believe it. I already know and love so many of the people on the show now. I'm just psyched to get in there and roll with it and have a great time.
I'm so excited for you. That's going to be great. I will definitely watch.
Do you know the band?
Yes, I know.
Paul Simon.
Whoa!
Are you gonna play with him?
Paul Simon?
Are you gonna play with him? Are you gonna play banjo with Paul Simon?
I don't know.
Oh my God! You have to.
You have to.
Oh God!
All right, I'll tell them that you said that.
Yes.
Yes.
Chris Hardwick says, I'm going to stop you right there. I'm so excited. So Hangover 2 and you're hosting SNL and then the Office continues. Thank you so much for coming in. And then where can people get more information about Whiskey Sour Radio Hour?
Well, the Whiskey Sour Radio Hour doesn't have its own web presence or anything, but the LA Bluegrass Situation, has a site, labluegrasssituation.com.
Cool.
And we just wrapped up, the second annual. So we'll be back in a year.
If I didn't piss off the higher ups, aka you, by being out of town in Florida this past weekend, I would love to come back and sing some bluegrass
tunes. Thin ice, Hardwick. I don't know. Yeah, no. Well, of course.
I'll send you some audition tapes.
You're already invited back.
I'll send you some audition tapes. Thank you so much, Ed Helms. It's good to see you.
That's been an abject pleasure, gentlemen.
That's it.
Jonah, come back.
No, I'm PCO.
Good Doppler effect.
Thank you. What's that?
I said, enjoy your burrito. Thanks, guys.
All right. So I was going to play Hart and Firm's Rodeohead, which I am positive I've played on the podcast before. Instead, I was able to find the Punch Brothers quite easily, actually. They did a cover of Packed Like Sardines in a Crushed Tin Box on the deluxe version of the album Anti-Fogmatic, which is available on the iTunes. So go there and buy it now because it is phenomenal. All right, so here's the Punch Brothers with their cover of Packed Like Sardines in a Crushed Tin Box. Here on the Nerdist Podcast. Buy their album.
Get off my case. I'm a reasonable man. case, get off my case, get off my case. I'm a reasonable man, get off my case, get off my case, get off my case.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast was brought to you by Carbonite Online Backup. Easy, automatic, unlimited backup for your computer files. Try it free for 15 days at carbonite.com. Use the offer code Nerdist.